This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Said to have drawn millions in an international stand against the biotech giant. Community organizer and artist Beth Reconce was on site for the demonstration, and she spoke with KBOO's Robin Ryan about the crowd, the message, and what steps may come next.
I've got Beth Reconce on the phone, and she was in attendance at the March Against Monsanto on Saturday, May 25th in Holiday Park. Tell me, Miss Beth, how do you think it went?
Right before the march, there was Idle No More PDX. There was a round dance to bring prayers and blessings for a good day, and the sun was out. It was beautiful. Thousands of people showed up, and it was just a wonderful event. Once the whole march got rolling and to see all the people file into the street and just to see how far and how long it was going and to hear at the beginning of the march the band, you know, Love Bomb Go-Go up there playing, and then to hear the Hell No GMO start, and then to hear the whole wave of it throughout all 6,000 people walking through, that to me, when you hear that wave and all the voices raising at the same time, that was most significant because, you know, we weren't just preaching to the choir. People were hearing it. People were seeing it. We were out there, and that was awesome. And also knowing you were doing it in conjunction with places all over the world, that was really big.
Share with listeners some of the primary concerns folks have about this corporation.
You know, the GMO issue is tied to the very health of our environment, and Monsanto has put corporate profit before the welfare of families and the environment by failing to honestly represent the facts about GMOs and the science behind them. Like the tobacco industry, the agricultural biotech industry is caught in the same kind of financial quandary. Do we face the facts and lose millions in profits, or do we just hide the facts, keep it going, and wait until the problems come up in the future? So my concern is that it's profit over people. You know, Monsanto is one of these corporations that is taking indigenous lands and other areas. There's no foresight or thought into the future, how it's going to affect our health, the health of the planet, the well-being, the amount of resources used just to create these things that have no proof that it's going to be safe for us in the future is not worth the risk. Our children are not experiments.
Are you aware of what some of the follow-up activities might be and how soon they'll come to pass?
I know there's a lot of talk. People, I'm looking at the Facebook page, and I see a whole bunch of people saying, can we do that again next week? A lot of people are awake, alert, and motivated and energized and want to keep moving. I know that October 12th, there's a call for another March Against Monsanto. I know that May 30th at OSU, there's going to be a speaker from Monsanto, and there's a few events that I'm noticing popping up on Facebook that, you know, we're going to get rolling on, and we've got to keep this moving.
Tell folks where they can go to get more information if they want to participate in the next event.
There's a March Against Monsanto Portland page on Facebook. They've updated the event page to keep it open so we can keep planning and keep coming together. There's March Against Monsanto, I think it's MAN.org, which is another local to keep us in touch. There's GMOFreeOregon.org, which has got information, petitions, events, actions that are continuing. There's Occupy Monsanto, and they too have got lists of activities and things, actions that are going on presently and are in planning. So keep your eye out on social media, and I'm sure there's going to be a lot of information. A lot of people are motivated, energized, and ready to keep going. We have a lot of work to do.
For KBOO News, this is Robin Ryan.
An AARP Oregon survey in Jackson and Josephine County has lessons for every community about what it will take to keep their residents over 50 happy and productive later in life. In conjunction with the Oregon News Service, KBOO's Serena Fong has more.
A new survey of voters over 50 in two Oregon counties offers some hints about what kinds of changes communities will have to make in order to allow people to age comfortably and as independently as possible. Jackson and Josephine counties in southwest Oregon have some of the largest percentages of residents over age 50 in the state, which puts them ahead of the curve in dealing with the latest demographic trend of aging baby boomers. AARP Oregon says at the top of the survey wish list is affordable and accessible housing. But Dan Bruland, an AARP volunteer in Medford, also cites mobility as a top priority.
Some of the things that people need that makes a place livable, such as public transportation or sidewalks, it really makes it better for you whatever your age is. And a lot of this is things that just allow people to remain active.
Of the 1,500 survey respondents, 68% said it's extremely or very important to be able to remain in their homes as they age. And 88% think their town or city is already very livable, with a few adjustments. AARP Oregon has been sharing the survey results with local business and government leaders this week. Bandana Shrestha with AARP Oregon says the survey points to the need for intergenerational contact between groups like senior centers and local universities.
It's encouraging to know that older adults want to connect with the younger generation and are looking for opportunities for that. When we talk about age-friendly communities, we are really talking about a community that is, you know, a place where people of all ages and ability can work, play, and live.
In conjunction with the Oregon News Service, this is Serena Fong with KBOO News. A Klamath Falls man has received debt forgiveness for close to $50,000 in student loans he accrued while pursuing a law degree. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has found in favor of Mike Hedlund, who waged a 10-year battle against lenders over his massive student debt that was forcing him and his family into poverty. Student loans are traditionally considered the only type of debt that cannot be forgiven during bankruptcy proceedings. But this case may change that and open other options for borrowers suffering under student loan debt. Natalie Scott, the Eugene lawyer who represented Hedlund, emphasizes that the decision relied on his good faith attempts to repay. These failed in part because Hedlund did not pass the bar and was thus unable to use his law degree, instead taking a lower paying position as a junior probation officer. The court found that Hedlund had proved that he met three measures necessary to have his debt forgiven: a good faith effort to repay, an inability to repay and maintain a basic standard of living, and a likelihood that the inability to repay would continue. Hedlund tried repeatedly to work out a payment plan that would maintain a basic standard of living for his family, but failed to reach an agreement with lenders that both parties felt they could afford. His case was bolstered by the fact that he made partial payments and worked full-time at a well-paying job. It was only when a single lender tried to garnish $1,000 in 1 month that Hedlund filed suit to have the debt discharged. He now owes $35,000 of the original $85,000 amount, an amount that he described as equivalent to a car as opposed to a house.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by Labor Radio, discussions on working class issues at 6. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline, connecting with the community inside. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is expected to be mostly cloudy with some scattered showers throughout the day, highs near 62 degrees. Tuesday evening should see rain later in the night, with lows around 53.
It is 5:13, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Sometimes the collusion between big corporations and our government is so ridiculous, so rancid, that it makes you laugh, cry, and gag all at once. And then you pass out from the sheer stink of it. That's how I felt when I saw the compromise that Senators Chuck Schumer and Orrin Hatch reached on the big immigration overhaul that recently oozed out of the Judiciary Committee. Some people oppose this reform bill because they claim it provides amnesty for foreign workers who entered our country illegally. But with the foul hash cooked up by Schumer and Hatch, what it really provides is amnesty for America's avaricious, wage-busting high-tech tycoons. Such plutocratic princes of Silicon Valley as Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook and Larry Ellison of Oracle have glommed onto immigration reform as a way to punt more of their highly skilled American engineers, programmers, and scientists out the door, replacing them with cheaper foreigners they want to import from India and other low-pay lands. These narcissistic billionaires are spending millions on campaign donations, lobbyists, and front groups to loosen immigration laws so they can wave in more than 110,000 foreign techers each year through a channel called the H-1B visa. It's no surprise that Schumer, a weak-kneed Democrat nicknamed Corporate Chuck, caved in to the tycoons. Not only does the bill nearly double the number of H-1B workers coming to displace Americans, but Schumer meekly accepted Hatch's amendments to let tech bosses give jobs to foreigners without first offering them to our homegrown professionals. Under another Hatch hatchet job, high-tech giants will even be able to fire Americans in order to bring in H-1B employees. This is Jim Hightower saying, to help fight this, go to www.aflcio.org. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Last Friday, notorious Arizona Sheriff Joe Arpaio was found to have violated constitutional protections against racial profiling by a federal judge. Arpaio has become known around the country for his humiliating punishment of undocumented workers in Maricopa County and a long list of alleged ethical violations. This ruling was a result of a class action lawsuit brought about by Hispanic drivers who allege that Arpaio's policy of saturation patrols intended to identify undocumented immigrants using race and ancestry as key factors in deciding who to stop. Well, Arpaio and the Maricopa County Sheriff Department claim that race has never been a factor in their enforcement strategy. Judge Murray Snow found otherwise. He identified a systematic and endemic policy of profiling has governed Arpaio's strategy and ordered the department to cease and desist. Cecilia Wang, an ACLU lawyer who represented the plaintiffs, called the ruling, quote, an important victory that will resound far beyond Maricopa County. A separate investigation by the Justice Department into civil rights violations by Arpaio's department is still underway.
The U.S. Supreme Court is set to rule as early as this week on whether or not the University of Texas can use race as a factor in its admission policies. The case will provide an important precedent for the fate of race-based affirmative action programs around the country and will potentially play a vital role in structuring minority positions in the next generation of elites. Nearly 12.5% of the nation's working population is black, but a substantially smaller share of the highest-paying jobs are held by African Americans. Only about 5% of the nation's doctors and dentists are black, and only 3% of the country's architects. These percentages have remained unchanged for more than 20 years, according to a sociological study conducted by the Queen City College of New York. Representation in American law firms had increased steadily for women and blacks until 2010, when numbers fell for the first time, in part due to the recession. John Page of the National Bar Association, an organization of black lawyers and judges, says that this shift could represent diversity fatigue and that the uptick in minority representation could reverse itself quickly. Page cited a few possible factors of the so-called diversity fatigue, including a misguided sense that the race problem had been largely overcome, as proven by President Obama's victory, and less visible social practices like shared churches and recreational activities that separate black elites from traditional power structures. Top law firms often experience difficulty retaining minority lawyers, as the recession has discouraged a focus on diversity, and traditional assumptions about minority quotas have returned to a competitive job market.
At Guantanamo Bay Prison, the hunger strikes of detainees continues, with some strikers being cleared for release and force-fed by U.S. soldiers. KBOO's Jimmy Tardy brings us a report on President Obama's speech regarding prisoners at Guantanamo. He also spoke with Brian Wilson, a Portland hunger striker, in solidarity with the strikers at Guantanamo.
In a speech delivered at the National Defense College on Thursday, President Barack Obama outlined, among other points, his intentions to address the situation regarding detainees held at Guantanamo Prison. In his speech, the president highlighted the fact that he has attempted to close Guantanamo in the past, that the U.S. Congress prevented that from moving forward, and that he will instruct the Department of Defense to, quote, designate a site in the U.S. where we can hold military commissions. The president further stated, that he will lift the moratorium on detainee transfers to Yemen, and that he will insist on judicial review for every detainee and, when appropriate, bring terrorists to justice in the United States' civilian and military courts. These remarks come as hunger strikes held in solidarity with hunger strikers at Guantanamo continue around the country. I spoke with Brian Wilson recently about his motivations for joining those hunger strikes at City Hall.
There's a trip planned for Cuba to go near Guantanamo and fast for a little while outside the gates, which I think is a good idea. And they're trying to get religious leaders and other groups to have a big press conference next month at the White House, outside the White House, about force feeding and demanding trials. In a way, all of this, including my fast, distracts from the more fundamental issue that there was nothing legitimate in the first place about snatching these people off the streets in Afghanistan and Pakistan and Iraq in the first place. I just wonder whether fasting for the end of the force feeding, in a way, kind of assumes that it was okay that they were there in the first place, but the force feeding is not okay. It's not okay that they're there at all. I want to challenge the whole United States assumption that we had a right, morally and legally, to go to Afghanistan, Iraq, and now Pakistan to do anything. Snatch people, bomb, invade. It's the supreme international crime called aggression. And it's like after 9/11, it's just kind of assumed that that was okay. To me, it's like it's such deeply, so deeply racist that we can identify people 9,000 miles away who we call Muslims and do anything we want. Do anything we want. We can bomb their village. We can bomb everybody in the village. We can snatch them, take them to torture centers in Bagram or in Abu Ghraib, then bring them to Guantanamo. We can do anything we want. And then I read this quote from a former guard at Guantanamo. He said, well, we were told they're not human, so don't talk to them. And he said his superiors, that was the orders from superiors. So that's racism. It's like once you have this mindset, you can demonize other people and do anything you want.
That was Brian Wilson, a hunger striker in solidarity with detainees at Guantanamo Prison, who are protesting their continued detention without charge by hunger striking. KBOO's Jimmy Tardy spoke with him at Portland City Hall last week.
Today, New York City kicked off its long-awaited bike share program. The new system, called City Bike, has thousands of bikes spread across 300 stations throughout areas of Manhattan and Brooklyn. Yearly, weekly, and daily passes will be available to the public, with some options proving cheaper than the subway. 11,000 residents had already signed up as annual members in anticipation of today's launch, though the kinks in the system are still being worked out. New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg has worked on promoting cycling in the city, adding over 350 miles of bike lanes in recent years. The city chose today to open the new program, anticipating low traffic due to the holiday. Many New Yorkers voiced optimistic hopes for the system once it works through its growing pains.
Last Sunday, a sea of protesters marched through central Paris in opposition to a reform the unpopular government passed in April. Numbering in the tens of thousands, activists expressed their mutual disapproval of same-sex marriage by hanging a banner on the ruling Socialist Party headquarters, calling for President Francois Hollande to resign. What began as a grassroots campaign strongly backed by the Roman Catholic Church has since morphed into a wider movement, with opposition politicians and far-right militants airing mutual discontent with the unpopular Hollande. Although it failed to block gay marriage, the protest movement hopes its show of force will stop or at least slow down further laws. These include allowing assisted procreation and surrogate motherhood for gay couples. President Jean-Francois Cope of the central-right political party, UMP, and several other party leaders joined the march, urging young protesters to join his party as a new UMP generation and campaign against the left-wing government. But several other UMP leaders, including former conservative prime ministers François Fillon and Alain Juppé, kept their distance, saying lawmakers should exercise their influence in parliament rather than march in street protests. France's first gay marriage is due to take place this Wednesday in Montpellier, France, the country's self-proclaimed capital of gay culture. France is a traditionally Catholic country, following 13 others, including Canada, Denmark, Sweden, and most recently Uruguay, and New Zealand in allowing gay and lesbian couples to wed. In the United States, Washington, D.C., and 12 other states have legalized same-sex marriage as of this date.
Shareholders for ExxonMobil, the most profitable company in the United States at nearly $45 billion this year alone, are set to vote on including sexual orientation in their anti-bias policy at their annual meeting next week. While nearly 90% of Fortune 500 companies have chosen to include sexuality as a protected right, according to Human Rights Watch, ExxonMobil has moved further away from the growing consensus. The issue, now making its 14th appearance before the annual shareholders meeting, has relatively broad support from the rank and file of voting members, with nearly 40% voting in favor of a non-discrimination policy. Higher-ups at ExxonMobil, however, have gone to great lengths to refuse such protections to the gay community. While they comply with national laws and with national law in countries that expressly forbid discrimination on grounds of sexuality, ExxonMobil has used loopholes between federal and state laws in the U.S. to avoid including these provisions. Little rationale has been provided by the spokespeople for ExxonMobil, other than a statement that all forms of discrimination were discouraged at the company, and that the corporate position was a, quote, board decision. Last week, a gay advocacy group called Freedom to Work filed suit against the corporation after filing two false resumes for a position in Illinois. The, quote, stronger candidate, who represented themselves as gay, received no communication, while a candidate designed to appear weaker but heterosexual received multiple callbacks.
And now we go to the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Monday, May 27, 2013. Settlers attack Palestinians in occupied East Jerusalem, and troops kidnap civilians from the West Bank. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. On Monday at dawn, local sources reported that extremist Israeli settlers defaced 15 Palestinian cars and punctured their tires in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in occupied East Jerusalem. Local residents said that the settlers conducted their act apparently during early dawn hours and left the scene. Similar to dozens of similar attacks, the settlers wrote racist anti-Arab and anti-Palestinian graffiti. Also on Monday in occupied East Jerusalem, dozens of Israeli settlers illegally occupied two Palestinian stores near Al-Aqsa Mosque in the Old City part. Local sources said that dozens of settlers and Israeli police officers are currently surrounding the two stores that belongs to members of Wazwaz Palestinian family. Local sources have reported that dozens of residents also gathered at the scene amidst increasing police presence. Furthermore, Israeli policemen and personnel of the Department of Revenue broke into several Palestinian shops today in the Old City part. On Sunday evening, Israeli soldiers kidnapped seven Palestinians, shot and wounded several others during clashes that took place in the Old City of occupied East Jerusalem. Two more Palestinians were kidnapped near Jenin. In other news, Israeli daily Haaretz has reported on Monday that in 2012, Israel confiscated 8,000 dunums of Palestinian lands in occupied West Bank for the benefit of its settlements in areas referred to by Tel Aviv as state lands. Haaretz said that expanding the boundaries of settlements in the West Bank and Jerusalem prepares for the next phase of construction bids, and added that the annexation of the land was made under orders made by commander of the Central Command of the Israeli military. The 8,000 dunums that were illegally annexed to the settlements in 2012 are equal to the size of Bat Yam in the center of the country, Haaretz said, and added that settlements in the West Bank currently occupy 583 dunums, or 133 acres of land. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, May 27th News Roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Hassam Kassis and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032.
Our production team for tonight's newscast is Jimmy Tardy, Evan Oven-Stively, John Rasmussen, and Robin Ryan. The producer is Serena Fong. Special thanks to the reporters from laborradio.org. Our engineer is Danielle Parks, and the KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg.
A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with.
The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. And Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120.
You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K264AA Corvallis 100.7 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Serena Fong.
And I'm John Rasmussen. Stay tuned now for more national and international news from the worker-run collective at Free Speech Radio News. Good night, Serena.
Good night, John.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Memorial Day, Monday, May 27th, 2013. I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. Today we spend the half hour looking at veterans and the challenges they face along with their families.
It's just unfathomable that my son or any soldier comes back and gets treated that way.
With how it is now, it's basically like if your brother raped you and your dad had to decide the case.
They told me it saved their life to see that, to see someone just be vulnerable and open and not care and just show that I have emotions from what I experienced.
Veterans, their families, and advocates fight to change the culture in the military and create their own solutions to help repair the wounds of PTSD, suicide, and military sexual trauma. That's all coming up. Stay with us. As people across the U.S. mark Memorial Day, many families will be honoring a loved one in the military who lost his or her life due to suicide. Last year, more active duty and reserve troops committed suicide than were killed in combat in Afghanistan. The Department of Veterans Affairs estimates that about 22 veterans take their lives each day, though their assessment only includes information from 21 states through 2010. One of those service members is Jacob Andrews. On April 5, 2011, Andrews, a 22-year-old veteran suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, and possible traumatic brain injury, hanged himself outside his childhood home. FSRN's Danny Wood met with Jacob's mother, Lori Turner, at the family home in Kansas City, Missouri. Danny started by asking Lori if Jacob told her much about what he was experiencing when he was deployed to Afghanistan in January 2009, where he was a gunner involved in heavy combat.
I would get calls more frequently than I expected. He would actually call me while he was on patrol and have his phone in his helmet, and we'd talk. And I know when Peter Cross died, he called me that night, and he was in tears.
And Peter Cross died in an accident when a Humvee rolled over him, and he was a friend of Jake's.
Yeah. Jake was the first one to reach him. He was running down the mountain, taking his gear off so he could go faster, and he actually ended up tumbling down the mountain. And when he reached him, nobody should have to see anything like that. That was the turning point for Jake.
When Jake returned to Fort Drum in January 2010, he began to be disciplined by the military for drinking and disorderly behavior. The next 9 months were difficult. He was dealing with PTSD, possible traumatic brain injury, a suicide attempt while he was drinking heavily. He was eventually given a general discharge and returned home. Where do you think the military fell short during this period in getting Jacob the post-combat care he clearly needed?
Well, first thing, I think there should be some kind of program put in place and for soldiers coming back to acclimate to the system and to cope with what they've seen and done. In particular, in Jake's case, there were many opportunities for him to get help. The particular person that was in charge, you know, in every situation, you know, at work or whatever, you have personality conflicts. My son was a very good-looking boy, and he was a little bit cocky. The person, and I don't know if I can use his name for legal reasons, but was somebody who was able to go to college, so he came in as an officer. He wasn't in Afghanistan with Jake or any of them, so he had no idea what they had been through. And I actually have some records saying he had appointments to go to medical appointments, and he had to call and cancel them because his command would not let him go. I know they had to have an inkling that he had traumatic brain injury, because I have one sheet of paper dated August 10th, which is the month to the day before they booted him out, that he was to have a traumatic brain injury follow-up. He never got that. And there was this particular counselor that was actually trying to get him into the Wounded Warrior program in Denton, Texas. And when the paperwork would go over to command, the response